The following podcast may contain spoilers.
Hello and welcome to Binge Movies, episode 69. I'm Jason.
And I'm Pat. This is a show that binges movies, sequels, reboots, franchises, and flops.
On this episode, our feature presentation review of 2018's A Quiet Place,
which currently holds a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Pat, we are going to do our definitive rankings on the films of Emily Blunt from the start of her career, Devil Wears Prada, all the way through Mary Poppins Returns. And we're also going to be talking, giving our instant reaction to A Quiet Place 2.
Every time you hear the following sound, that means it's a reference to something pre-COVID and we fucked up. Just consider it a botch or a boner, whatever your preference is, and ignore it and continue on enjoying this episode. Thanks.
We figured what better movie to do a feature presentation review on during that time of, this blunt mania we're going through. We're two blunt men, right? We're two blunt boys. what better time to do A Quiet Place as a feature presentation review?
Yeah.
It's been out for a few years. We can do a little bit of a look back, but it's not too nostalgic. We get the sequel, which, when this comes out, you'll know what our thoughts are.
Yeah, I give you a little behind the scenes before.
Yeah,
the sequel comes out.
Based on the box office, I think the entire world has seen A Quiet Place.
Hopefully by now.
Yeah, I think so. This movie made a lot of money. Was this one you caught in theaters or no?
No, this was something I watched much later. I think
you didn't get caught up in the mania of it, because this was like a big deal.
It was everywhere. Everybody was seeing it. It was in theaters for a while.
And you just couldn't be bothered.
Yeah, I was watching Speed 2 Cruise Control.
And now in 2018, that was during our hiatus, and so that's probably why you didn't see it. At that time,
we were quarantined.
Well, anytime there's a quarantine joke or a bunker joke or a apocalypse joke, please keep in mind this was all recorded before real bunkers, apocalypses, and end time scenarios were happening. So, whoopsie!
I was free and living my life amongst society. I'd set up a life in rural St. Louis with a family and some children. And one day, all of a sudden, I felt a pain in my neck. I passed out. I woke up and was back in this bunker and broadcasting back to the world my endless, endless thoughts and musings about movies.
This is all news to me. I was told we were in quarantine.
By quarantine, yes. I mean, I was in quarantine, just one cell over from you the entire time. Moving on! I think without much further ado, I think it's time to get quiet about what we were just talking about and shift our focus to what we're really here for, our feature presentation review, 2018's A Quiet Place.
Military fighting a massive invasion.
Around the world.
Total devastation.
Pat, let's ignore all the discontinuities in our canon. Let's focus on a game we play at the top of all reviews, pass or recast. This is where we determine whether or not we believe the performance is worthy of a pass or whether or not the role should be recast by another actor or actress. Of course, let's start off with our Angel of Verdun herself, the Full Metal Bitch, Big Bad Booty Mama. Cut that last one out.
Keep it in.
hey now.
Oh, no. Yeah, Dev, cut that.
Yeah. Emily Blunt as Evelyn Abbott. Pass or recast?
I'm giving it a pass. She is phenomenal in this movie. She's the strong, badass mother. It's kind of like a different perspective than we saw her in, you know, Live, Die, or Repeat. Definitely different from The Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And I think she nails it.
Biggest difference between this and Devil Wears Prada, no garish eye makeup.
Or some bright of her, color hair.
Some of her eye makeup in The Devil Wears Prada was yikes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think she's great. She's got a lot of work here to do because she doesn't have the benefit of dialogue. I mean, none of these actors really do. But she's given some of the most complex emotions, guilt, maternal instinct.
Birth.
Yeah, exactly. Giving birth in dead silence during the apocalypse at a dusty old farmhouse. Yeah. And if she's not the quality of actress that Emily Blunt is, then maybe this movie doesn't work as well. Maybe it's a little more Bird Box than A Quiet Place, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little bit more straight to Netflix and not straight to box office gold. So I think she does great. It's an obvious pass for me. What about John Krasinski, the director of the film, who also is the real-life Mr. Blunt?
Yeah. Because that's how that works. Because she's the superior.
Let me just say, that guy will wake up every single day of his life and
be happy.
Thank
that
the good
Mr.
Lord above that he's
Mr. Blunt.
Mr. Blunt.
Yeah.
Yes. His answer should always be, yes, honey. Yes, ma'am. Yes, whatever you
yes,
want.
Yes, I am Mr. Blunt.
Yes, I am. Yep. What do you think? What do you think about him as Lee Abbott? Good old Papa Abbott.
I think we should recast him with Dom DeLuise.
Okay. I see that.
Yeah. I think that's Emily Blunt and Dom DeLuise have a better chemistry on screen.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the biggest struggle would be that Dom DeLuise is trying to restrain his flatulence.
Yes.
During the apocalypse.
Exactly.
Yep. I get it.
And also keep his monkey in the basement of the barn.
Of all the times to own a monkey, the apocalypse would probably be the least advantageous.
It would. Yep. That is the conflict in their marriage, is him owning a monkey that constantly makes sound.
Oh, yeah. They have to build a little monkey coffin with an oxygen tank to carry it around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the movie I wanted.
I want a movie about monkey coffins. Yeah. Post-apocalyptic monkey coffin films. I think that's going to be the new Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah.
Moving on. Pass, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pass. Millicent Simmons as Reagan Abbott. Who's a real is a deaf in real life?
Yeah, she is deaf. I give her.
We're notorious for hating child actors.
Yeah.
What do you think about this kid actor?
You know, I give her a pass.
Me too. I think she's actually really, really good.
Yeah,
yeah. What about Noah Jupe, who I also just recently saw in Honey Boy, which is one I missed in theaters. Finally got around to seeing it. Great film. If you have a chance, I think it's free on Amazon Prime. If you're a Prime member,
I have to check that
check
out.
It out, man. It's a quasi autobiographical film about the life of Shia LaBeouf. And he wrote it while he was in rehab, and it's about his childhood, and he plays his own father in it, and how he didn't get an Academy Award nomination for the 2020 or 2019, 2020, whatever you say, Academy Awards. I don't know. It's a harrowing film, to say the least. It's rough stuff, but definitely worth a watch.
They don't like Shia LaBeouf, the Academy.
Well, understandably, right? Yeah. And that's part of what the movie's about, is about his adult life and his childhood life. It flashes back and forth, and Noah Jupe plays the young Shia, who they call Otis in the movie, and he's great in that, and I think he's pretty good here too as Marcus Abbott.
Yeah,
I give him a pass.
Definitely pass on this one.
And what about Cade Woodward? He's in about 2.5 minutes of this film before he's brutally murdered.
Yeah,
what'd you think of him as Bo Abbott?
Bo, you know, I give him a pass. I think he's
dumb kid.
Yeah,
real dumb, but
he's a kid,
very young child,
so you can't really blame the kid. So, yeah, for the very few minutes we see him on screen, I think he's pretty good.
Yeah, me too. So it's passes all around. We're passing everybody. No recast for A Quiet Place.
Or no recast children for little
maybe
people.
The first time ever.
Yeah.
Yep. This is a great film. Straight off the bat, there's no point in pretending it's not. And you immediately know it just by how this movie looks. With the opening shot of the film, we the lights, the colors, we get a woman who is obviously Emily Blunt, as they're silently scavenging for supplies in a deserted town and market. There's a young girl who appears to be deaf, and a young boy, and an even younger boy, and this woman is like presumably the mother of these kids, and they're going around like this little country bumpkin pharmacy, grocery
it's
store.
Pseudo like everything all in one store, because
like a Five and Dime.
Yeah, because they have everything. It's like a CVS sort of store, mom and pop, small store.
And they're looking for medication because one of the sons, a middle aged son, is very sick, right? And so the youngest child, he's reaching for a spaceship toy when he almost drops it in there, because we see a little conversation where they're like drawing with chalk or whatever.
Yeah, he draws like a little rocket.
He's like, this is how we can like get out of here. This is how we can escape and be safe. We get a rocket. And lo and behold, there's a rocket toy in the store. He reaches up, almost drops it. His sister silently slides across the floor, catching it before it can make any noise. And this opening tells us just about everything we know about this family and this world. Obviously, these people are doing their darndest not to make any noise.
Yeah.
And we get this is a loving family. And as they are living through an apocalypse, something as simple as a kid getting sick has now becomes a major ordeal, right?
Yeah. Comes difficulties, you know, medicine's not as readily available, and you have to scavenge for supplies.
Yep. Then we finally pan over. We see like a male figure standing in the doorway, essentially watching guard. This is, of course, John Krasinski. And the dad tells the boy that the toy is too loud, that he can't take it with him. He very carefully takes the battery out of this. And the way that Blunt and Krasinski sell their little toddler boy walking up to them with a toy spaceship, it's as if he's walking toward them with a loaded gun or a hand grenade. The terror,
the fear
that just washes over them with just a toy rocket ship is incredible. Tells you everything you need to know.
And his slow, subtle movements. Like,
to get the batteries out, yeah.
Well, not even that, because he like slowly moves to grab the toy from him and then opening it up. Yeah, it's just perfectly done.
It's perfectly done. The characters we have, of course, now we have our introduction to the family. We have the Abbott family. We have Evelyn, the mom, who's Emily Blunt. We have the husband, Lee, John Krasinski. You have the congenitally deaf daughter, Reagan, and sons, Marcus and Beau. And they, while out in the open, the family's traveling barefoot, which I can't even imagine. How do you travel barefoot in all seasons? How do they do this in the snow? They're kind of in the south, but still.
What they probably do is they probably hoard as much supplies as they can for winter.
Yeah.
And stay inside as much as they can.
That's probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
They travel barefoot via sand walking paths to reduce noise. And Beau,
which is brilliant.
It's very brilliant.
Yeah.
We see the sister gives him back the spaceship, but not the batteries. She said, well, you can have it, but if there's no batteries in it, it's obviously safe, right?
Yeah.
And we see the boy eye the batteries in it. I think it cuts before we see him take them. And we're following this family, right? And the camera is on Krasinski and Blunt, right?
Yeah,
and which one's carrying the oldest son? Blunt?
John is. Yeah.
Right. And that's right. You're right.
Yeah.
Because it comes up later.
Yeah.
And Blunt's behind them. And then we have the Reagan, the daughter in the back.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. It's almost out of focus. You just kind of see the kid coming in and out of frame in the back as they're walking.
Because, they're walking single file.
And he's got the rocket ship in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't draw too much attention to it, but it catches your eye enough to know, oh shit.
Yeah, and
we're in trouble.
He's also walking several paces behind everybody else, too.
Which is very realistic. He's a little kid, new mm-hmm. toy. He's just caught up in his world of imagination. He doesn't understand the stakes. Even though he knows there are threats, it's really hard for a kid that age to like really get that you can't make any noise.
Yeah.
It would be very difficult to raise a child under these circumstances. Beau activates the toy when the family is walking home and crossing over a bridge, giving away his location to a nearby creature, which kills him before Lee can save him. Because here's the other thing. Krasinski's character can't scream. Drop the toy, throw the toy. Because presumably, if the kid throws the toy, it's going to follow the noise, right?
Yeah.
Little kid's going to freak out. Little kid's going to
freeze.
Panic. Krasinski and Blunt can't make noise, because otherwise the whole family gets killed. The only thing he can hope to do is get to that kid quick enough to chuck the toy. And he can't do it because these things, whatever these creatures are move incredibly fast.
They're fast.
And the kid is just snatched right in front of the frame of the camera. Boom, title card. Quiet Place.
Yeah.
And within less than 10 minutes,
less
I feel like
minutes.
We're hooked. I was hooked.
Yeah, you're in.
How do you feel?
I was in, by that, because it's such a jarring, shocking moment, because it's quiet. It's eerily quiet.
Yes.
Because there's no music playing. It's just dead silence from this opening scene. You hear some ambient sounds, like, you know, leaves blowing across the ground and stuff like that.
It seems like it's maybe early fall. Maybe.
Yeah. And you can hear, like, their feet going through the sand and stuff like that. But yeah, it gets dead silent when he starts playing with the toy.
Yeah.
Because they cut all sound. And he starts running.
We go into the perspective of the sister, and the sister can't hear.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's right.
So every
time
cuts.
Every time they go into her, it sound completely cuts, which is actually a great technique. I love that.
Yeah.
So we hear nothing, and then it cuts out of the perspective of her, and I think it's in the perspective of the boy almost.
Yeah.
And you hear the rocket ship and him playing with it, and he's just gone.
He's gone.
Like,
now, and here's the thing. Think about it as a parent. Even if your impulse, of course, would be to scream to save the child. Your other impulse would be to scream out of grief because you literally just watched your child get snatched and murdered and probably torn asunder, ripped to shreds.
Yeah, violently.
Violently in front of you, right?
Yeah.
And Emily Blunt, it goes to her face, and she has to literally stifle her screams and her grief, essentially swallow her pain in that moment, which is really what this movie's about on a thematic level, about swallowing your pain, right? It's about just eating your feelings, eating your emotions, because it's too dangerous to let them out.
Yeah.
And so this movie, within the first 10 minutes, tells you it's not messing around, and it's beautifully shot, but here's what the world is. Here's how these people have to live. Here's how they're surviving. Here's how they get from point A to point B. Here's how they've been able to survive, because they know sign language, because they have a deaf child. And this is a world in which, whether to save your children or mourn your children, you can't make a noise.
Yeah. And we get that in 5 minutes with no dialogue.
All of your parental protective abilities have been stripped from you.
Yeah.
This world is fundamentally not safe. And therefore, you as an audience, you don't know what's going to come. You don't know what's next. If we're willing to kill the littlest kid
instantly
in the first 5 minutes, we'll kill anybody.
Yeah.
And the movie routinely does not pull its punches like that, which is why I think it's so effective. We cut to day 472. Family lives in their barn because the house is too noisy. The old
crickety boards.
Yeah, the floorboards. Over a year later, Reagan is struggling with guilt over her brother's death. Evelyn is in the final months of pregnancy. And Lee is fruitlessly trying to make radio contact with the outside world while also discovering if these creatures have a weakness. This is where we get whiteboards of exposition.
Yes.
The most glaring and popular criticism of the movie is that there's just newspapers and giant whiteboards spread all over the place to talk about the invasion and the creatures. And he has weaknesses circled, sound is key, and all these sort of things. Here's the thing. The whiteboard is the only... How do you get exposition across in a movie without sound?
Yeah, and... I think that's fine, is having these newspapers sitting around, because he's trying to research these things.
Right.
And it's fine to have the whiteboard with, you know, weaknesses and traits of what these creatures are, so he's trying to, understand it.
Mm-hmm.
The trope I hate is explaining exposition in movies verbally to characters that should already know these things.
Sure.
So... how else would he have done it, even if they had spoken dialogue? His wife's going to know all this stuff, especially by day 479.
472.
Or 72.
Yeah.
So, who else would he explain things to if they had verbal dialogue in that scene?
So you're saying these whiteboards don't bother you?
No.
I think where it does bother me a little bit. It's not like some people are like, this ruins the movie. I don't understand that. It doesn't ruin the movie for me. But at a certain point, there's so much information on these boards. It's not just giving us exposition. It's telegraphing plot points of where the movie's going to go, especially on a second watch. If you look at that board, it pretty much tells you exactly what's going to happen in the movie. And I don't find that clever. I find it hand-holding. I find it as trust your audience to be able to make these connections. And it's not so much egregious here, but it's especially egregious in the end of the film. We'll get to it.
When it circles around. Yeah.
He's got on there, how many are in the area? Confirmed, 3. He's got a box around it. Weakness, the question mark, with all caps. You know, it looks like a presidential tweet. he just has all, he's like all of these little things of like questions. How will we survive? Like all this sort of stuff. It's like we're already asking these questions as an audience.
Yeah.
You don't need to force feed it to us like this.
I guess some of those I can agree with, but because, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a question that's on your mind constantly. You don't need to write it on a board.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
We see Evelyn dealing with her grief and yet also her simultaneous excitement and hope and fears as she prepares a little nursery for this next child that she's going to have. And Blunt has to do all of this full range of emotion. She's getting set up for a new child while her youngest child has died just a year ago. And so she's as excited as she is. She feels guilty of her excitement. The kid is both a replacement and a new opportunity, but you can never really replace the child you lost. And so that full range of everything is right there on her face.
Yeah, that's a lot to deal with too, especially not being able to talk about it either.
Yep. Lee climbs atop a grain silo to light a fire, and we see others in the distance doing the same. And Reagan goes to call Lee to dinner, and we see in this interaction just how distant they've grown from each other. But there's obviously still love, but there's this unspoken thing between them that they just can't seem to get past, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so here's another thing where just visually, there's no other way to convey information in this film, we are seeing how communication works in this world, right? It tells us there's other survivors and there's one and there's one and there's one.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy.
And how important nonverbal communication really is too.
Yeah. And just how they function in this world.
Yeah.
In a believable way too. This movie was at one time considered to be part of the Cloverfield universe. Would you have liked that, or tonally do you feel like it's better as a standalone? Because it doesn't really fit with Cloverfield, but it does fit with 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah, I can see 10 Cloverfield Lane more. I like it better as a standalone film because I think Cloverfield, their stuff is kind of doing their own thing.
Sure.
So I like it better as not being attached to that. But I guess it would be interesting if it had some sort of loose connection to 10 Cloverfield Lane. Like John Goodman's character was like one of those neighbors.
Could be, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah, could be. Or maybe he worked at the same company, the same satellite company that Goodman did, which is why he's got like an engineering kind of background or something like that.
So yeah. they
just a subtle way to work it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The family is eating steamed veggies from their floorboards, which I don't know how that worked. How does that work? They're pulling hot food out of the floor. I have no idea what that contraption
is.
It feels like
there's a water thing. So I wonder if it's heated water.
I felt like something that it's probably how they live in Iceland or something. It felt very Norwegian or Icelandic to me.
Yeah.
But it's like you're living in a chalet somewhere in Switzerland, just pulling steamed vegetables from your floor. I don't know. I was like, what? Where's this hot food coming from? I didn't understand it.
I think the reasoning is to keep it quiet.
I get that, but I don't know how it works. She lifts up a floorboard. And hot food comes out.
It's a replicator.
Okay. Okay.
It has a Star Trek connection.
Everything goes back to Star Trek with you. It makes sense. Everything goes back to Quantum Leap with me and Balki Bartokomous, and everything goes back to
Star Trek.
Star Trek Picard for you. They're also playing Monopoly with nice little soft pieces, and you know Marcus the son topples over an oil lamp in his excitement and shatters, which ends up drawing a creature to the house. And the instant response and the reaction, they're not even worried about the fact that they almost got the house on fire. They're worried about the noise. This is a world in which your child burning to death is a better fate than
being ripped apart by
a monster.
Yeah.
This is an important scene in the movie, and actually Krasinski explained why it was important during an interview he did with Vanity Fair back in 2018.
So this is one of my favorite scenes because it's a movie about a family that needs to remain quiet. This is such a perfect atmosphere and one of the best scenes to tell the rules of how to remain quiet and what happens if you don't. These Monopoly pieces we thought of for a long time. You can see we kept the same colors. So these reds are still hotels, but they're fluff balls from a craft store. So the kids, because of the mother being such a loving mother, she wants them to feel that they have a normal existence even though they have anything but. And all the pieces are obviously things from her crafts or sewing kit or something like that so that the kids can play but not make noise. We knew that sound would not only be a main character, but it would be the character. It's actually the thing that frames the entire movie together. But more than that, it became about adhering to rules. What sounds literally that the audience hears are too dangerous, which ones aren't. it's impossible to live silently, and we knew that, so we wanted to bring the audience through this idea of living as quietly as possible. This is that old theory of loading a gun at the beginning of the scene to build tension, and this lantern will obviously become a huge part of the scene in that it is the first major noise you hear. As an audience, you've been given this entire field of information of how this family is living and why they're living that way. But the one thing you haven't gotten yet is what happens if they do make a sound. And so one of the first big noises in the movie will be from this lantern.
And it turns out at first we think that it's just a raccoon, right? When we, when everything settles down and everybody goes dead silent, we think we just see some raccoons. Raccoons end up scampering away, and one of them gets quickly killed by one of these creatures, showing us that danger is just outside the door at all times. You can never truly be safe. Lee is attempting to upgrade Reagan's cochlear implant with scavenged miniature amplifiers to restore her hearing, but the devices are all ineffective. Evelyn and Lee share an earbud dance, which was kind of romantic.
Yeah.
Showing that despite their losses they face together as a family, that they still love each other very deeply.
It's heartwarming and touching.
All of this was just one day in her life. Day 473. Boom. Cut to the next day.
Yep.
Evelyn is taking her blood pressure and preparing for her baby's arrival. Reagan attempts to go back into their old home, the creaky floorboards, and it was just really, this is really well thought out. All of the safe spots to step have been painted.
Yeah.
And marked, and just as she's about to go into the basement or something, which I'm not really sure why she was going in there. Did you ever figure that out? Lee comes up out of nowhere and ends up snatching her. It's like, it's too dangerous. You can't go.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why she's not allowed, but it just seems like she's just not allowed to go in the basement.
Just at the risk of her being in the house, she's going to make a noise, maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Especially since, you know, she can't hear, so
yeah.
She wouldn't be able to hear if she is making a sound.
That's probably it, yeah. And so she's obviously very upset at her inability to be able to hear. And she's going through adolescence, and she's living through an apocalypse, and she has guilt over her brother Bo, and she's trying to reconnect with her father. And so she's like kind of angsty for a lot of understandable reasons. Is like, you treat me like a child. I'm not a child anymore.
She's got a lot of pent up aggression.
I can take care of myself. And these two are just at odds. Do you find this relationship between the two of them believable, or is it a little too schmaltzy?
No, I believe it. Because, you know, a father in the apocalypse, he's going to do whatever he has to do to keep his family safe.
Yeah.
And teenagers.
Or preteens. Yeah, tweens, yeah.
Want to be treated like adults, even though they're not adults yet.
Yeah, nowhere close.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because she's going to want to be able to do things on her own without or being stuck at the farm while the family goes out. I think she wants to help, but she's feeling like she's being treated like a child because of her disability.
Yeah. Yep. So, and I think she also wants to help in a way of just trying to connect with her dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is he not letting her because he's trying to protect her, or is he not letting her because of maybe some unspoken feelings he has due to the death of their son? Or is it both? You know,
it's possible both.
That's what the subtext is going on here. Evelyn is actually homeschooling Marcus, so now we know how they educate their kids, who doesn't want to go out with his dad into the woods. Reagan tries her latest hearing aid, and she already tells him up front it's not going to work. We're cutting back and forth between the conversation between the son and the mom. It definitely seems like the boy's a mama's boy,
yeah,
and she's a daddy's girl to some extent, but he's more willing to take the son out and do things with the son than he is her. Is it a gender thing, or is it he's blaming her for Bo's death? Where's this? She's deaf.
I think it's because she's deaf. She's not going to be able to hear if she walks over a stick or something like that, or hear rustling in the woods.
Right.
Because he's going to be looking forward. Cause the paths are single file.
Right.
So he won't. If something's coming up behind her, she's not going to hear it.
Right. Yeah. It's probably.
More protection.
Yeah, it's probably more protective than anything.
Yeah.
She, of course, tries the hearing aid, and it doesn't work. And obviously, the dad, Lee, takes Marcus. They go off into the woods. And Reagan packs a bag, and she goes off to leave, too. Evelyn's in the basement during this doing hand washing, so we see how they wash their clothes, which is very quietly, which would take forever.
Yeah.
And she's, like, super freaking pregnant, carrying a giant bag, like a burlap sack of heavy laundry up the basement steps. Her bag gets stuck on a nail on the step, which is a setup. It's Chekhov's nail for a payoff that's going to come later. And a pregnant woman that pregnant should not be lifting something that heavy, even in the apocalypse. John Krasinski needs to do his chores.
Do
Why isn't he doing the washing?
He's out collecting fish.
Okay. Fish one wife, day, wash another day.
Well, yeah. Wife, sit down. Here's a book.
Teach the kids. I'll do the washing. Yeah. Right? Lee takes Marcus to a nearby...
Or at least let me carry the laundry up when
I
come back.
Yeah, leave it down there when it's done or whatever. Yeah, and I'll come when I come back, I'll hang it up. Good grief. Lee takes Marcus to a nearby river with a large waterfall to teach him to fish while Regan visits Bo's memorial. Lee explains to Marcus that they are safe from the creatures in the presence of louder and constant noises as the sound masks the sounds that they're making, right? So as long as they're by something that's louder than them and constant, they can talk, right? So if you're around something real loud, you can pretty much talk at a normal volume, even yell, right?
Which they do.
Which they end up doing.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're by the river, you got to stay mostly quiet, but you can speak a little bit, you know, just whisper, in hushed tones.
You have to stay under the decibel of whatever.
This kid ain't buying this shit. He's there sitting there pissing his pants.
Yeah. John Lee Abbott drops a fish in the water. Or mm-hmm. fish jumps out of his hand. Yeah. The kid freaks.
Yep.
Because it makes a kerplunk sound.
We are 38 minutes in this movie before we get dialogue at a normally spoken at a normal volume.
Yeah.
And the first words that are spoken is, "You're all right." It's very paternal, which I think is what this movie is really about. I think this is a movie about paternal instinct and
to protect your
protecting your family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marcus then reveals that Regan blames herself for Beau's death and needs her father to tell her he still loves her. He asks, "Do you blame her?" And after a long pause, Lee says, "No." And then he asks, "You still love her, right?" And there's no response. This is the halfway point of the film. We've had about 40 minutes now, and it's been high tension for 40 minutes. And all we've watched is people do their laundry, go to the grocery store, go fishing, and
have spats.
Do homeschooling.
Yeah.
Is this the most edge-of-your-seat homeschooling movie you've ever seen in your life?
It is the most riveting homeschooling movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, we need more homeschool representation in Hollywood.
There's other than underrepresentation of homeschooling.
What other movies are there that are predominantly about homeschooling other than The Buttercream Gang? You ever seen The Buttercream Gang?
Yeah, that's deep cut.
I'm confused, Pete. What do you really want?
I want you to hate me.
You want me to hate you? Why?
Because I hate myself!
Pete, you're my friend. I can't hate you. Can't you accept that?
No!
I haven't thought about that in 25 years.
If we get enough response, maybe we'll do a feature presentation. We'll do a bonus feature, instant reaction to the Buttercream Gang.
Would it be an instant reaction?
67 years after it came out. As Lee and Marcus head home from the river, they encounter an old man standing over the corpse of his wife who's been disemboweled. And the great thing about this scene is that the camera pans down, just shows enough of her bowels to kind of get the idea. That's the thing. If you're going to show a disembowelment, we don't need full bow.
Just a little bow.
Just show a little bow, and we get the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't need to see a giant gaping wound with all of the bowels exposed.
We've seen enough of disembowels.
That's exactly right.
To know what disembowels look like.
Yeah, we know what a prolapse looks like. We don't need to see the whole thing.
And we don't need to have you linger on it either, too.
Don't linger on a prolapse.
No.
Lee motions for the man to be silent, but the man intentionally screams in order to commit suicide by alien. Lee picks up, I presume they're aliens, because they're talking about like a meteor landing. Didn't they come from a meteor? Or was that, am I mixing that up with Edge of Tomorrow?
That's Edge of Tomorrow.
Whatever. M.A. Blunt's fighting aliens in an apocalypse.
Yeah.
All this shit's the same. Lee picks up Marcus and runs as the creature kills the man. This scene was very harrowing and awful in theaters. Well, what's your response to it?
You know, it's...
They picked, I think, like a real-life toothless hillbilly to do this,
yeah,
too.
And yeah, and it's... The scream he lets out is blood-curdling.
It is, yeah.
And I kind of feel bad for him because, you know, he lost his wife. I'm assuming she was killed by one of the monsters, or hopefully he didn't
her.
Yeah, have like cabin fever and just, you know, murder his wife.
Yeah,
and then,
he's definitely deranged by the time we get to him. The question, of course, is was he
deranged before?
Just tired of living in this world, so he killed his wife and then committed suicide. Maybe, maybe it's like a murder suicide.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because I mean, he's digging a grave and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. I don't know. It's blood pumping because he grabs his son and hauls ass, and he knows he can't get away too far. He needs to just get out of earshot, basically.
Yeah, and get real quiet.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're going to be meal too.
While this is happening, Evelyn's alone at the house and goes into labor. While making her way up from the basement, she steps on the exposed nail, and in pain, she actually drops a glass picture frame, which alerts a nearby creature. This woman's going into labor, putting a nail through her foot, dropping shit, fighting monsters. This is some tension-filled stuff. This is how a movie builds tension. And in a lesser movie, all of these things could feel so cliche and contrived. And yet, for whatever reason, the style, the presentation, the actors, the performance, the direction, it doesn't feel contrived to me. It just sort of works.
It is a perfect blend with all everything you just said. It just blended perfectly, and it just works so well. And yeah, her constant performance through this movie, like, it just escalates. Like, we think we're going to get in like one level, then she just takes it up to the next level.
Yeah.
She takes it up to another level, and we're like, by the time she's physically giving birth to a child in a bathtub,
right,
we're like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Cause she's,
and how is she going to survive this?
Yeah. Because there is a creature in the house, and she's about to push a baby out silently.
Yeah. And she's like, she's like trying not to give birth.
Yeah.
Right? Cause she's like, and how do you, it's just.
Cause I think what they were planning
it's
to
so
do
genius.
Is they built like a little sub, like in the barn is like pseudo, like soundproofed.
Yeah, it's where the nursery is going to be. Yeah, presumably she's going to give
birth
down
there.
There.
Yeah, so I think she's trying to like
scream her guts out like a normal person.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's harrowing. It really is.
Yeah.
It works. And I've obviously, to me, the real test is you watch a thriller like this. It doesn't hold up to repeat viewing because some of them they get you in the moment
because it's shocking and it's something you didn't see coming. Especially
for me. I'm sitting there in the theater. I saw this theatrically opening weekend.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there in the theater, and movies like this, like, you know, thrillers and horror movies and even comedies work this way. You feed off the energy of the crowd. So if the audience you're with is really in the movie, it helps you be in the movie. And when they jump, you jump, you know, because it's like you're reacting simultaneously, collectively, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you watch this movie in isolation, like to your point, after you know the jump scares and what's coming next, does it still get your pulse pounding? And I was sitting there going, this movie freaking works because I was anxious. I was nervous.
I felt
tension.
Your heart's racing. You're sitting up. You're like, oh, come on. Even though you know what's going to happen,
yeah,
you're still like, there's a monster. Get, hide, or do something.
You're invested.
You're into it.
Yep. Evelyn flips a switch that changes the exterior house lights to red, which is a danger signal to others, and she struggles to remain silent during her progressively more brutal contractions. Evelyn comes much more focused into character during this next part of the movie, because she's there and she's important, but she's kind of in the background. We're really focusing on Krasinski and the kids. This is where Evelyn kind of comes into her own as a character.
Yeah.
Arriving at the farm and seeing the lights, Lee instructs Marcus to set off the fireworks as a diversion using the word rocket. And the kid's like, no. And he's like, no, you have to do this. Your mom needs you to do this. So Evelyn makes her way into a bathtub. Thank God for claw-toed tooth bathtubs. As blood begins to pour from her, she's birthing a child in silence as a monster is skulking around their home. And she finally has no chance but to let out a scream in pain just as fireworks begin shooting off, masking her sound. Leo arms himself with a shotgun, and this immediately tells us we know that this guy knows there's no way out of this.
Yeah.
And right?
I love
the only choice he has to defend his family
is to
with
fight him.
The loudest freaking weapon, right?
That he has
in these,
available.
And
yeah.
They're like living in the hollers of West Virginia or wherever, Carolinas, wherever they're at. It's going to echo through that valley.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be loud.
And you know, he's essentially going to draw more to himself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I didn't catch it the first time I watched it, but watching it this time, I'm like, that guy's smart enough to know if he's pulling out a shotgun, this is a suicide mission for him.
Yeah,
right?
He knows it's over. And I love the little subtleness that he loads his shotgun under a blanket.
Yes. Just something, they don't draw that much attention to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Because I caught that this time as well.
Because it kind of looks like he flips his blanket open and then the shotgun's ready. But no, he has a box of ammo and he's preloading it.
Yeah.
Under it, just to mask the sound.
They're in this old creaky house and Evelyn's in childbirth. Lee has her shotgun. There's no way not to make noise. Arriving at the house, Lee finds Evelyn hiding in the bathroom, like a shower stall, with her newborn son. And along with Evelyn, he makes his way to their improvised soundproof basement, which you just talked about, which includes a baby sound dampening box affixed with an oxygen tank. And Lee leaves to find the other children because Evelyn swears to him and makes him promise that he will protect them. You have to promise me. You will protect them, Lee. You will protect them. And this is where Emily Blunt, 58 minutes into this movie, which is only an hour and a half, this is the most she talks in this film, and Emily Blunt goes into a speech. And he's like, no, don't go into that. And she starts talking about Bo. And this is where she gives an incredible speech where she's like, I could have carried him. He was heavy. He was so small. And she does such a good job talking about this fictional child the way a mom would really talk about a son who has passed.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
Sad. It's gut-wrenching.
It feels real.
Yes.
Even though this is a movie about
monsters and
aliens made of ears that come and chase you in the woods,
yeah,
this feels human and real, and she knocks it out of the park. Reagan is making her way home and is about to get eaten when her new earpiece emits a sound that repels the creature, but she is unaware of it. Evelyn falls asleep, but soon awakes to discover that the barn basement is flooded with water from a broken pipe and that a creature has found its way inside the basement hideaway to try to get to the water. Reagan, hurrying back to the farm, takes refuge atop a grain silo with Marcus, lighting a fire to alert their father of their whereabouts. However, they run out of lighter fluid and the fire dies before it can attract Lee's attention. Just when you think you're safe, you're not. Everything just starts going to shit again. A hatch door suddenly gives way. Marcus falls into a silo, and the sound of the door falling distracts the creature that's stalking Evelyn, and it begins to target Marcus and Reagan. And here's the thing. Anyone has ever been a country bumpkin in their life who's ever grown up around the Midwest or the country at all, anytime where there's like corn silos, grain silos, there are frequently children and people, and not even just children, like workers, people who work in farms, who die in grain silos.
Yeah.
If you happen to fall in one of those, you're fucked because it's essentially quicksand.
Yeah.
And the more you move, the faster you sink, and there's no way to get out. And it's...
Because it compresses and puts weight on you and it just suffocates you.
Yeah, and you would think, well, it's just...
Corn,
you should be able to get through it, but you can't. No. And you die very quickly, and it's awful, and it's terrifying. And so, like, I think this is the first time, like, here you are, right, where this is, like, the ideal white nuclear family living in the white picket fence country, growing a garden, and, you know, these are good old-fashioned, red-blooded, Chuck Norris-approved American conservative farmers.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, this whole thing is about, like, the danger of family life, the danger of family trauma, the danger of life on the family farm. Like, I don't want to read too much into it, but that's what's going on here, right? It's just amplified as a monster movie.
Yeah, it's like the monsters are secondary.
If you know anything about history, people had multiple kids because there's a good chance your kid was going to die on the farm. If your kid got sick, you didn't have medicine.
Yeah.
Like the...
Get tuberculosis.
Like the boy at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he could have died. He get pneumonia or something like that.
Something we take for granted. Like the flu.
Diarrhea.
Could kill your kid.
Yeah.
Working in a grain silo could kill your kid. Working around a
combine.
Combine, right. Could kill your kid or you lose limbs or like... Life is inherently dangerous, and we used to be more connected to that idea. This movie uses the high concept of a monster movie to show us the dangers that are lurking out there, that the world is still a dangerous place, even with...
Just don't get too comfortable.
Just take away... strip away modern convenience, and the world is dangerous.
Yeah.
Suddenly, all over again. So, it's very well done. Reagan jumps in after Marcus. She begins to sink into the corn after, like, sliding him the door... So he's able to get himself on top of the panel. So he's safe. She begins to sink and nearly suffocates. Marcus then has to save her. Regan's cochlear implant reacts to the proximity of the creature by emitting a high-frequency sound that drives it away. The children proceed to escape from the silo and are reunited with their father. The creature thing returns, and it begins to attack, and it wounds Lee. He has, like, an axe, and he's looking for it. It's above him. He goes to swing up, and it just... He doesn't even get close.
No, it just
whacks right into him, and he goes flying back. At this moment, you have to know that, I mean, he already knew by pulling out a shotgun, like, this is over.
Yeah.
At this moment, when he's pretty much almost disemboweled, he's got to know, there's only one way I'm going to get these kids out of here.
Yeah. I got to make noise to distract the creatures.
Describe the scene, Pat. What happens?
So, he's got his two kids in his truck that he just parked. I'm assuming he just parked at the end of the world and just left for there for all time.
Yeah, because
he can't run it.
He can't run it.
It makes sounds.
Right.
His son always has earlier scene to see him, imagining him driving.
Yeah.
So
they play in it, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
So they're inside the truck, and one of the creature is now attacking the truck. Because I think they made a noise when he got hit.
Yes, they did. They screamed or yelled something. Dad or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yelled dad, and it distracted the creature. It drew the creature to the truck, so it's just destroying it, breaking glass on top of it, ripping it apart, and he's just standing there, and her
implant and earpiece is starting to go nuts, so she just turns it off.
She turns it off
because it's painful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one thing that could have saved her dad.
Yeah.
She turns
off. I would assume it's going to factor in potentially to the sequel.
We'll
know by this point, but yeah.
Yeah. So he knows the only way to get his children safe, keep his promise to his wife,
which she made him swear repeatedly.
Yes.
And he failed before with Bo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is to sacrifice himself. And he signs to them that he loved, well, basically directly to his daughter.
Yes.
Because he knows the conflict, what's going on between them, and his son has verbalized it to them earlier.
Yeah.
Saying that, I love you. I have always loved you.
Yeah.
And then he lets out a blood-curdling scream.
Yes.
Just like the old man did.
Yes. What is in that scream?
Pain.
From what, though?
Knowing that he's not going to be there for his family.
I think
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's the grief that he can never express over his original son.
Yeah.
Or Bo, the original death. I think it's the world he's going to be leaving his family in. I think it's... He's never going to get to say goodbye to his wife. I think it's everything.
Not to see his,
his new child. I just think it's everything. I think it's all the pain.
Everything that, to this point.
And Krasinski.
And what could come.
Yeah, and Krasinski conveys it perfectly. Because just by him doing it, it's not a guarantee that his family's safe.
Yeah.
It's the only sliver of a chance they have that they could be safe.
Or to get away.
I think it's just everything this guy has not processed. It all comes out. It all comes out in one moment. I just think it's everything this guy has ever felt but never been able to process. It all just comes spilling out at him in this one scream.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Krasinski crushes it. I think this is his most effective scene in the movie.
Yeah, I might have to agree with you there because it's probably his most emotional scene in the whole movie.
Yeah. Regan and Marcus roll the truck downhill to escape and reunite with Evelyn and the baby at the farmhouse. The four retreat to the house's basement when the creature returns. Regan, who realizes the sound made by the implant distresses the creature, switches the device back on and places it on a nearby microphone, amplifying the feedback. This is the whack part. Mid-attack, she stops, and she, for whatever reason, just begins to read what's on this. Like, you have a monster that is in a basement with you, mere feet away. It is, for some reason now, just as slowly as possible approaching you.
Where it's been so fast and suddenly...
And it's going to eat your mom's face off, and it just killed your dad. And this kid stops and very slowly turns and line by line begins to read this whiteboard.
And then process that information.
And then processes that weakness, question mark. Oh, they don't like my implant. I'll turn my implant back on, and then I'll use this microphone and I'll crank the sound up, and maybe that'll work as a weakness or whatever. And the pacing of this, the way, it's not that it's there, it's that they linger on the whiteboard so long. It's not for that character's benefit. It's for the audience's benefit. It's for the slowest, dullest person in the audience to be like, I get it.
The sound, even though they've showed it about three or four
exactly
times
right.
by now.
It's already been set up.
Yeah.
This should just be the payoff. So, yeah, this is what doesn't work for me. Painfully disoriented, the creature exposes the flesh beneath its armored head, allowing Evelyn to fatally shoot it with a shotgun, which is obviously, they're safe, but it's going to draw more because the shotgun just rings off into a basement.
Yep.
The family views their CCTV monitor, showing two more creatures attracted by the noise of the shotgun blast approaching the house. With their newly acquired knowledge of the creature's weaknesses, the members of the family arm themselves and prepare to fight back. And this is where we get a Evil Dead 2 style.
Yes.
Emily Blunt, if there's a schlock moment, this is it. She's got the shotgun, and she pumps the shotgun like a total badass, mere minutes after giving birth, and cut to black.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids are ready, and you see that she, like, cranks all the things all the way up to as high as they'll go. And they're just going to presumably kill the rest of these monsters, right? Everything that comes in that basement's going to end up dead.
Yeah.
What do you think of this ending? Because in my theater experience, when the first time I saw it, the theater erupted. It was dead silent. When she killed the first creature, you could hear a sigh of relief. You went, oh.
There's a way.
But then when she pumped that shotgun, people literally went, fuck yeah. They were pumping their fists. Because this movie was like so relentlessly bleak and harrowing and tension filled.
Now there's that slither of hope.
When they give you that shotgun pump, which Resident Evil had how many shotgun pumps per movie? And it never had that response.
Yeah.
It was an earned shotgun pump in my experience. But you didn't watch it in a theater.
You know,
what was being alone in your pod, what did you experience?
I think it works just as well being alone in the pod. It's a satisfying moment.
Did you yell out, fuck yeah?
Yeah, I said, fuck yeah, motherfucker. Kill those motherfuckers. And just just kept saying fuck over and over again.
Fuck yeah, motherfucker. Cocksucker, motherfucker.
Shit yeah.
Shit more.
Oh, no.
You didn't?
No, but I internalized that. Respect the movie.
I see. Do you make noise very frequently?
No.
Is your life a real life quiet place?
It is, and I enjoy it, and it's beautiful.
When you're home, are you just dead silent? Like when you're in your pod, when you're in your own cube, is it just silent in there?
Yeah, and just, you know, stare at a wall until the TV comes on and required viewing is required.
I see. Right. Yeah. Until the next Dom DeLuise film shows up, and you're like,
which is frequently. I'm like, yes, Dom DeLuise.
Do you say that loud or is that internal?
It's internal.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. This is not
fingers crossed
a horror movie to me, as much as it is a tense thriller about grief.
Yeah, I could see that definitely for sure.
It's about the silences that fill our closest relationships
and things are never spoken.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's about parental fears, right? What's the parents' greatest fears? Threats against their children, right?
Yeah.
It's about the things we so deeply fear talking about in our families and with our families. And also beyond all that wonderful undergraduate level film studies analysis, it's just a darn entertaining and effective film at creating tension.
Yeah.
It's an hour and 30 minutes, and it's highly efficient, and it does everything to build this world, these characters, and it does more in an hour and 30 minutes than the new Star Wars movies did in three films.
Yeah, it does. I agree. Yeah, you're in it from the moment the movie starts, because it slowly sucks you in,
mm-hmm.
and then you're on the ride for the whole way through. There's not really a lull or something that just kind of meanders through it. It has a good pace. It wraps up quickly, but it doesn't feel like you've been only, it doesn't Sometimes I complain about like movies feeling like it's too long.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel short.
No.
But it doesn't feel like it overstayed its welcome.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It
doesn't feel like it's missing anything. Because sometimes we've watched movies and we're like, this movie, and it doesn't feel like it ever got off the ground.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily feel long. It feels incomplete. This movie is short, but it's complete.
Yeah.
It's a complete story, and you've taken a complete emotional journey from beginning to end.
And it's satisfying.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, obviously, we've been very effusive in our praise of it all the way through, so I highly doubt we're going to come in and be like, it's a 2 out of 10. This movie sucks.
Fuck this movie.
Yeah, I give it a 9.25 out of 10. 9.25 stars out of 10 possible stars. I guess that's what they are. They're stars now. But yeah. What do you give it?
It changed from
your points, stars, whatever.
Episode to episode.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I gave it a 9.2.
9.2?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm slightly higher than
you're
you.
You're a 0.05.
0.05, right? Why not a 10 out of 10 for you? Or one out of 9.5, right? I know we're split hairs at this point.
Yeah,
but because is there anything about this movie that doesn't work for you? I obviously have my gripe about the whiteboard stuff. I don't harp on it as much as some people on the internet like to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But
whiteboard stuff didn't really bother me that much.
Is there anything that does bother you?
I wanted a little bit more detail on some things. But, I mean, maybe they'll be answered in the sequel. Maybe that's why they have a sequel now.
You wanted this movie to be 50 hours long.
I did. I wanted to live in this movie.
A lot of times we watch movies and we walk away with the conclusion that maybe this would be better as a TV show.
Yeah.
Would A Quiet Place be better as like a Netflix series or a AMC series?
I feel it would end up like Walking Dead and I would hate it.
I think the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it would be a very similar premise to The Walking Dead, but then
you'd
have
one good season and the rest would be garbage.
You would have no talking through the entire series.
Well,
maybe a few conversations.
Yeah, you'd find workarounds. They'd be whispering. There'd be a lot more basement stuff.
Yeah.
You'd find, I agree. And that's partially what makes me nervous about doing a sequel. When they announced the sequel, I was sort of like, I didn't think we needed more.
Where could you go from here?
Yeah.
Just Emily Blunt being road warrior and driving around and just blowing the heads off of monsters?
Which she'd be great at it.
She would.
But that just feels not akin to this. It just feels so different.
Yeah, it feels it would stray from what this is.
It feels like a dumbing down of it. This is a pretty simple, contained story with limited characters. It's got like a little bit of an indie horror vibe.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
There's the movie It Comes at Night, which is even way less horror than I think people thought it was going to be, myself included. I saw that in theaters. That, to me, didn't work. And I saw this one. I was reluctant to see this one because I'm like, I don't want another It Comes at Night. And then this one worked for me. It was, even though it was a little bit more mainstream and a little bit less artsy fartsy, but I think it's just a all around entertaining, crowd pleasing film with some good emotional beats.
Yeah,
A Quiet Place is there. I'm nervous for the sequel, which we'll get into our thoughts with that in our instant reaction.
Yes,
to A Quiet Place 2.
There we go.
So that's our review of 2018's A Quiet Place. On our next episode, we'll be giving our definitive rankings for the films of Emily Blunt, which includes 2006's The Devil Wears Prada, 2014's Edge of Tomorrow, 2015's Sicario, 2018's A Quiet Place, and 2018's Mary Poppins Returns. Pat, we are not done with Emily Blunt yet. That sounds creepier than I intended it to.
Yep.
We are going to be looking at her career. We, of course, are going to be starting with The Devil Wears Prada, and we're going to be going all the way through to the Mary Poppins sequel. I know that you're a big Mary Poppins boy.
I am. Watch that on repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a big time Mary Poppins.
It'd be better if Dom DeLuise was in it, but
what
we can't get it. I mean, you can't get everything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. There's no justice in this world. That's all I can say. If there's no
after
Dom
this
DeLuise.
Episode, there's going to be so many hits on Google on who Dom DeLuise is.
I don't know where to go from there. Didn't Dom DeLuise used to sell bacon bits? I feel like he used to sell something.
Something?
Yeah.
Doing commercials?
He definitely did commercials.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who do we talk more about on this show, Dom DeLuise or
Balky?
Kevin Dunn.
Kevin Dunn.
We haven't talked about Kevin Dunn or Patron Saint in a long time.
That's true.
He's appeared in like the last few seasons.
I know. I mean,
when was the last time we saw him? Like a
Transformers?
A Few Good Men or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think you might be right. That was what, 93?
Yeah. So it's been a couple years now. Yeah. Do we just get rid of Kevin Dunn as our patron saint? Is it time to move him aside and move Dom DeLuise in?
I don't know. Maybe he's. I don't know if Dom DeLuise can replace
Kevin Dunn. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe what we need to start doing is diving deep into some of the Dom DeLuise catalog.
Oh, boy. I mean, yes.
And when, right? And apparently it's not bacon bits. I my recall was not right.
It wasn't.
Ziploc bags.
Okay.
Because I remember the commercials because he was obese. So he'd get up in the middle of the night and eat leftovers out of the refrigerator, and the leftovers were kept fresh all night.
Oh, yeah.
In Ziploc bags.
There you go.
So if you're going to, if you want to contribute to the obesity of America, which now 40% of all Americans are considered obese.
Well, you need to bump those numbers up.
Who better to bump those numbers up than Dom DeLuise, the patron saint of obesity? He started a movie called Fatso.
Did he?
Yeah, so maybe we could be the patron saint of fatso-ness.
There you go.
Well, that's what you do with saints. You keep their bodies under glass, and then you cut their fingers off and sell them because they have healing properties. Only thing is, his wouldn't have healing properties. It would have flavor properties.
Flavor properties.
Gravy would come out of his fingers. And
this one's Cheetos.
Umami.
Ooh.
I get a hint of Dom DeLuise umami.
It tastes like ranch.
I don't know where we go from here now.
Is that ham hock I smell? No, that's Dom DeLuise.
That's fresh Dom DeLuise.
That's dry age Dom DeLuise. Somehow we've gone from Emily Blunt to cannibalism. You never know what you're going to get here at Binge Movies.
No.
We, at some point in the future, will have to determine whether or not Kevin Dunn, our patron saint, it's time for him to be dethroned and for a new patron saint to be added. The late, great Dom DeLuise, who... We're talking about eating his dead flesh.
We've never talked about eating Kevin Dunn. So there's that.
Fuck. Oh God.
We just fell apart at the end here.
I know.
We just fell apart.
We were almost real film critics for a minute. we flew too close to the sun, so, Pat.
We had, reality had to step back in.
Yeah. We got sucked into a gravitational pull of Dom DeLuise. We came right back down to Earth.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing. We've never talked about eating Kevin Dunn, but there was a movie in which Dom DeLuise ate himself. Spaceballs, Pizza the Hut.
That's right.
He ate himself to death.
Yeah.
Which is a horrible,
horrible way to
morbid
go.
Obesity joke. Different time,
yeah,
folks.
Yeah,
different time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, up next is not Dom DeLuise. I don't know
at all. You'll have to wait till later in the season.
I guarantee we're the only movie podcast that talks about Emily Blunt and Dom DeLuise in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And pitched a fan movie of them together.
Oh, yeah, yeah. As lovers.
Yeah.
Until next time. So until next time, binge on.
See ya.